what he did in the film world. But starting, I think, in 1981 with a spy novel, and then continuing over the years and becoming his full-time occupation, as it were, since, I think, 2005, he has become a full-time writer. He's written at least one spy story, at least there's one that I've read. He's written about the paranormal, he's written things that you would describe as thrillers, and in particular, you may have heard of him as someone who has developed this fantastic series of crime-stroke detective books, the Roy Grace books, Roy Grace being a Brighton-based policeman who solves crimes in and around Brighton, which is where Peter is from. He's had phenomenal success with both of the Roy Grace books and with his other things. I make it now that he's got 35 novels, that he's been published in 37 different territories around the world, so very heavily translated and so on. Sold over 18 million copies worldwide. He's had 11 consecutive Sunday Times top panelists and awards, etc. He's got an honorary doctorate from the University of Brighton for his service to literature in the community, and I think the community refers to his very extensive work in charity. You get the picture. This is a man who's had a very full life. He's got more awards and prizes for his writing than you could possibly shake a stick at. But I'll just add one to the list we managed to put into the festival brochure this year, because it's, I think, the most recent one. In 2016, the Crime Writers Association Diamond Dagger Award was awarded to Peter Dane to mark sustained excellence and significant contributions to crime writing. Well, Peter Dane, welcome to Birkenstead.
Thank you, Mike. I'm not sure what I can add to that. It's kind of ironic, being born and growing up in Brighton. Noel Coward once described Brighton as, dear Brighton, peers, queers and racketeers. And the late Keith Waterhouse said, you know, Brighton has the air of a town that is perpetually helping the police with their inquiries. Very fortunately for me, not much has changed. Recently, I had an email from a detective who'd been walking on plain clothes along Western Road in Brighton and saw a villain he'd been looking for 2 years. They legged it after him, chased him for about a mile and a half, finally rugby tackled him, cuffed him and took him up to the custody suite. As he was booking him in, this villain turned to him and said, you know, you're just like a cop in a Peter James novel. But it can be a very ego-bruising business to be an author. A writer friend of mine was on a train a while back, and he saw a lady sitting opposite him reading one of his books. And there's always a moment when that happens, where you think to yourself, do I say something or do I just keep quiet? And he watched her for about 15 minutes, turning the pages. So he plucked up courage and said, excuse me, he said, that's my book. She went, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I found it here. Then she closed it and handed it back to him. Said I wasn't really enjoying it anyway. When I was a child, I was one of those irritating brats who's always writing letters to their favourite authors. I wrote to Enid Blyton once, and I said, dear Miss Blyton, I've just read Five Go to Treasure Island, and they spent 7 days on this island, and not one of them went to the lavatory in all that time, and I'm very worried. She wrote a very sweet letter back saying, well, they had gone, but she just didn't think little boys and girls were interested in that stuff. But she would bear it in mind. So throughout my childhood, I read everything else that Enid Blyton wrote subsequently in the hope that one day, somewhere in one of those books, someone will be having a dump. I started as a Sherlock Holmes fan, and loved his work, above all the other English crime writers, but I was a big Christie fan as well. But then, when I was 14, something happened that was to change my life, quite literally. I read Graham Greene's Brighton Rock, and I put that book down, and I just promised myself that one day I would try to write a crime novel set in Brighton that was maybe 10% as good as Brighton Rock. That was a book, and I'm very honored to be here today. It's really a delight because he has been a massive hero of mine. And Graham Greene's Brighton Rock, in my view, changed the landscape of crime fiction. Because up until that point, certainly in the UK, crime fiction, under the kind of eyes of Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, all the Golden Age writers, even Doyle himself, had a structure which was you tended to have a dead body, chapter one, and the rest of the book would be the puzzle to solve it. Graham Greene changed that landscape. And he changed it in more than one way. The first big change was that he had, and it taught me the importance of a gripping opening line. You know, I still think the opening line of Brighton Rock is one of the most compelling ever written in all of fiction. Within 3 hours of arriving in Brighton, Hale knew they meant to murder him. You kind of have to read on. Who's Hale? Why is he in Brighton? Who's going to murder him? And then, second thing is that Hale is still alive at the end of chapter one and in peril, which is very much the structure of all the kind of traditional great American thrillers. But up until that point, the English never sort of did that. You kind of had to kill the body. And the third thing was that it was probably the first crime novel that I certainly ever read that examined wider issues. You know, Pinky is horrible, nasty 17-year-old teenage gangster killer who's a devout Catholic, terrified of eternal damnation. And the issues in the book, and I do think it has unrivaled still today, the darkest, psychologically darkest last line ever written. That's just staggering. And it was beautifully captured in the original David Attenborough film as well. But the first thing that I ever got published was a little bit different. It was a story I sold to Private Eye for the princely sum of 10 shillings back in 1966. I can see a few of you, almost as old as me, and who probably remembers what 10 bob was. For you youngsters, it's probably about 10 quid in today's money. And it's a true story of an American inventor called Reuben Tice, who decided that more people might eat prunes if they weren't wrinkled. So he built a steam compressor to de-wrinkle prunes. And he was decapitated when the machine exploded. As Mike very kindly said, I wrote a number of different genres of novel before I actually came to crime writing. Started with spy thrillers. I wrote a number of supernatural thrillers, psychological thrillers. I was always wary of trying to break into the UK crime writing world. I felt there was a very strong elite following in those traditions of Conan Doyle, Sayers, Agatha Christie, with a very rigid set of rules that you dare not break. There seemed to be that convention that you needed to write a mystery that combined sex, violence, culture, religion, and invariably a country house setting. So I came up with what I thought was probably the perfect opening line. Fuck me, I've been shot! So the vicar's wife. As her knickers hit the library floor of Ponsonby Towers with a crash. I have so far spared my readers this line, but one day I promise you. My interest in the police came, started back in 1981 when I just had my first novel published, Dead Letter Drop. I don't advise you to rush out and buy it. It's not very good. And I got burgled, and I'd recently got married. I can strongly recommend getting burgled to any newlywed couple, because it gives you the perfect excuse to explain why all those horrible ornaments you've been given are not on display, you know. Auntie, you know, that porcelain donkey with the quartz clock in its stomach, they took it. But a young detective came to the house to take fingerprints, and he saw the book, and he said, oh, if you ever want any research help with the police, give me a call. And he was married to a detective, a guy called Mike Harris and his wife, Renata, and they invited my then-wife and I to a barbecue at their house, and almost all their friends were also police officers. And over the next, which is very much the case, they tend to kind of stick within their own fraternity. And over the course of the next few years, we got to know them better and better, and I met more and more police officers of all walks, from response, traffic, homicide, SOCOs, divers. And I found these people absolutely fascinating. And I began to realize that nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a cop. In a single day. And what happened was, after a while, they started to realize I was genuinely interested, not just out to get a story I could flog to the newspaper. They started inviting me to come spend time with them. I get invited to go out on a day's patrol with a response crew or traffic crew. And it got to the point within a few years where they'd phone me up, so we're doing a raid tomorrow, do you want to come with us? And today, probably 30-odd years on, I'm almost part of the furniture in Sussex Police, and I have terrific access to them, and it's helped me enormously, because I do believe that the three most important things in writing fiction are character, research, and plot. And I put research above plot, because anyone who reads, by the very nature that all of you in this room are here right now, you're intelligent people. I don't think we read just to get a story and find out who done it. We actually read to be entertained, to be enthralled, but I think above all else, we read to learn about life, about the human condition. That's why the joy of books. And when I started spending time with the police, I quite often do a 12-hour shift with a duty inspector. And an example of a day I spent quite recently, at 7 o'clock in the morning, were called to a cot death. Young couple, their 2-month-old babies died during the night. And it's a terrible situation. The police have to give them pastoral care. But at the same time, they've got to be mindful this couple might have murdered that baby. So that's a crime scene. A very difficult line to tread. An hour later, we're called to a house of a woman whose live-in boyfriend's just pushed dog shit in her mouth. 11 o'clock in the morning, a Turkish student's hit by a bus in the middle of Brighton. The paramedics say he's going to die. His girlfriend doesn't speak a word of English. They've got to find a translator for her. Fortunately, he did survive. At 12:30, we're at the home of an elderly couple who've just been swindled out of their life savings by an online fraudster. And the day goes on. And in 1995, I was introduced to a man who was to become key in my life. He was, at that time, a young detective inspector in homicide in Brighton. And a couple of friends in the police said, oh, you might enjoy this guy's company. He's a bit quirky. So I walked in his office, and I've never seen an office so untidy in my life. It was literally floor. Every inch of the floor was covered in blue and green crates bulging with manila folders. And I could just see his head at the back. I said, oh, are you moving? He said, no, these are my dead friends. I thought, great, I've met the only weirdo in Sussex CID. And he then explained, he said, I'm a homicide detective, but I've also just been tasked with reopening all the unsolved murders in the county, and trying to apply the latest developments in DNA and fingerprint technology to see if we can move them forward. He said, each one of these crates is the principal case file of an unsolved murder, and the last chance the victims have for justice and that their families have for closure. And I loved that very human image about him. And he said, well, what are you writing at the moment? And at that time, I was writing a psychological thriller called Denial. And he said, I was about halfway through. He said, tell me about it. So I started thinking, hang on a sec, your character wouldn't have done that. And why hasn't he got an outside inquiry team doing this? And I don't think they'd have done that. And I realized, I thought, wow, this guy has got, he's not just a sort of wooden top plod, he's actually got a real creative side to him. And over the next few years, we became good mates, and to the point where when Laura, my wife, and I got married 2 years ago, he was best man at the wedding. And he basically what happened was I realized that a good homicide detective is far more than so often we see them portrayed. They have, a really good one has two completely different and contrasting skills. One is they have to be incredibly anal in that they're so methodical because every major crime is a huge collection of moving parts, hundreds if not thousands of pieces of a puzzle that have to be painstakingly put together. But at the same time, so many homicides are actually solved by real out-of-the-box blue sky thinking. And the best detectives are the ones that combine those two. And Dave Gaylor is just one of those. And he rose up through the ranks and in 2002 became Detective Chief Superintendent and basically head of major crime for Sussex. And my publishers asked if I'd ever thought of writing a crime novel and creating a fictional detective. So I went to Dave and I said, would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved the idea. And my Roy Grace is very closely modeled on him. Unlike Roy, Dave does not have a missing wife. Well, not yet, anyway. but we work very closely together on every book. We sit down, we plan the plot together. He reads every 100 pages, tells me how Roy would think and act as a real police officer. And it helps me get that authenticity that, for me, is so incredibly important. And I do think that the police have been horrendously maligned in recent years. I think our Home Secretary, and now Prime Minister, dear Mrs. May, has done a terrific job of completely decimating the British police force. Morale is, I've never known morale so low at a time when we need our police more than ever in this most dangerous world we're in. And I see it all the time, how upset, and sure you're going to get bad police officers. You know, there's 250,000 in England, you're going to get some rotten apples. But the vast majority, people who go into that job, not to make money, but because they want to do a job where they can actually make a difference to the world. And I think it's one of the few careers where you really can make a massive difference to people. And I just think they need more support than they're getting right now. I'll just give you an example of how the public, I think, sometimes view them. I was on patrol in Islington about 18 months ago. I was with a sergeant and a PC, and we're in this car. And the sergeant had been limping. I said, well, how'd you hurt your leg? He said, well, it was just over there. And he points at a bank. He said, these three blokes came running out of the bank with balaclavas on their faces. Didn't look good to us. Never accused Plod of not being smart. He said, so we jumped out of the car, and one of them turned around with a machine pistol. And we hit the deck, and they ran off. And I thought, I'm not having that. Got up, ran after them, shouting, stop, police! He said, they split three ways. Rather stupidly, I went after the one with the gun down the side street. He suddenly turned around, pointed it back at me, aimed at the ground, fired. The bullet ricocheted off the ground, went into my right knee. He said, I was rolling around, the worst pain I've ever been in my life, effing and blinding my head off. 2 days later, this smartly dressed elderly lady walked into Islington Police Station and said, I wish to make a complaint about a police officer using foul language. It was pointed out to her by the sergeant that this officer had very bravely, unarmed, attempted to tackle a man with a machine pistol. Yes, but that's all very well. There was no need for him to use profanities. I think murder intrigues us all because it's the only crime for which there is no possible restitution. And the vast majority of killers are male. And they've always fascinated me. But female ones do too. I do a lot of talks in prisons. One of the charities I support is the Reading Agency. And a terrible indictment on our education system is that the average reading age in a British prison for 50% of the inmates is below 11 years old. But I was doing a talk about 5 years ago in a women's prison, the same one that had Rosemary West and also Mrs. Canoe Lady, Mrs. Darwin at one time. And I was giving a talk to this audience, and there was this one lady in the audience who was asking very smart questions. And it's quite interesting. Men's prisons are categorized A, B, C, D. So A, you get maximum security, terrorists, multiple killers, and B, down to D, are the open prisons. In women's, they tend to lump them all together. And I've noticed they tend to sit in groups. So you'll get a group of about 18 to 25-year-olds who tend to be the sex workers. Then you get sort of 20 to 40-year-olds who are the drug dealers. And then you get this group of 40 to 60-year-olds who are the husband killers. And there was this one woman in this latter group who was asking very smart questions. She actually asked a question about Graham Greene, about Thackeray, about Dickens. And I thought, wow, I wonder what you're in for. And my guess was that maybe she'd kill someone drink driving, something like that. Anyway, one of the big bangs for me is I get to mingle after I've done my talk. So I circulate and I make a beeline for her. And it's not etiquette to ask somebody what they've done. So I kind of have an icebreaker. I say, oh, how much longer do you have to go? And she looked at me and said, 9.5 more bloody years. And it's just not fair. There's a woman in London who did exactly what I did. She's only got 6 more years. I said, oh, yeah, what brought you in here? Well, I poisoned my mother-in-law, the old bag. I said, okay. She said, well, the thing was, see, she went into hospital to die. So I embezzled a bank account. Bloody woman didn't die, she came home. Well, you know, I realized she'd find out what I'd done, so I had to poison her. But then I realized my husband would find out, so I had to poison him too. And it's just not fair. This woman did exactly what I did. I'd be taken out, and I said to the officer, is that lady for real? He said, yes, sir. Husband was 3 months on life support, he's got permanent brain damage, and she's just angry about the length of her sentence. The world of crime and law enforcement never stands still. The police and villains are always playing kind of catch up with each other. And about 12 years ago, I was at a 9 o'clock management meeting at Brighton Police Station. They jokingly call it morning prayers. They have this meeting every morning and they review everything that's happened in the last 24 hours in and around the city, burglaries, wanted people, missing people, the lot. And the commander turned to me and he said, you've come on a historic day. This is the first time since records began. There's not been an overnight domestic burglary in Brighton and Hove. I said, fantastic, you've won the war on crime. And he laughed and he said, today's burglars are becoming more and more dinosaurs. He said, people stay up later, they have lights, they have cameras, burglar alarms. He said they can earn far more money, drug dealing or internet fraud. And he was incredibly prophetic because today, internet fraud has become the fastest and the nastiest growing crime throughout the Western world. I think in Sussex alone in the last 12 months, 1,500 people have lost a staggering 15 million to internet fraudsters. And I'll bet there's not a single one of us in this room, including me, who hasn't been targeted at some point by some fraudster either trying to get you to give details of your credit card or something. It is absolutely rife. And one of the nastiest ones is I did quite a lot of research. My current last book, Need You Dead, it kind of revolves around a suspected kind of internet fraud which triggers off an act of violence. But the City of London Police They have an economic crime unit, which is the primary policing for internet fraud throughout the UK. And one of the nasty ones is called the Friday night scam. And it's a couple buying a new home, a flat or a house, and they're desperate to exchange contracts. The villains will have hacked the lawyer's computer through malware and be watching all the transactions that are happening. And imagine it's you, you want to exchange contracts before the weekend, you don't want it to linger on until Monday, and you get an email from your lawyer saying, hold on a second, we've just got some small issues, and I'll get back to you in an hour or so. This goes on till 5 o'clock, when the lawyer will have, switchboard will have come off, and the office shut down for the weekend. Soon after five, you get an email from him saying, right, this is the account to send the money to. You send the deposit money for your house or flat, 100,000, 150, 200, for most people, their life savings. And that money will be out of the country within about 5 minutes of it hitting that account, because the hackers will have just given you the bank account that you've been familiar with, but with one digit difference, maybe a full stop in a different place. That accounted for £300 million in the UK last year. So if you're buying or if you're moving house, really do be careful. And don't accept any instruction you get from a lawyer when you can't check him first. And far more widespread are online frauds at a much smaller level. The police are so, as I said earlier, are so overwhelmed these days, they actually can no longer investigate any online fraud under £3,000 and more in most counties. Just checking time, make sure we have time for Q&A. I'm often asked if I get scared doing my research. And the answer is yes, quite often. Sometimes, because I'm in a dangerous situation, accompanying officers on a rooftop chase, or standing beside them when they put a door in on a known violent criminal. But something that left a lasting impression on me and chilled me to the bone, even to this day when I think about it, was when I was in the States, in Los Angeles, listening to an emergency call, a 9/11 call, made by a woman utterly terrified that her estranged husband was going to kill her. The call started quietly, the woman clearly afraid, saying she had locked herself in the bedroom and the husband was trying to break into her house. Before the call handler had dispatched a police car, she began screaming that the man was now in the house, and we could actually hear hammering sounds. And the woman was crying, stammering that she was trying to break the door down. He was trying to break the door down. And then her voice turned to stark terror as he succeeded, and we just heard five gunshots. And I've used elements of that in Need You Dead in my last book, because I thought it was such a powerful and horrific moment. When people say that truth is stranger than fiction, they're right. I don't believe there's anything I can dream up in the darkest recesses of my mind that will ever exceed something that's already happened out there in the world. But I'm always melding kind of truth and fiction in my books. I did this at a domestic violence scene, which I used very early on in Need You Dead, and which mirrored an incident I attended the police. I referred to a little bit earlier. It was about 7:30 one morning. I was spending a day with a response crew, and we got called out by a woman saying that her live-in boyfriend had just put dog feces in her mouth. And we shot round to a very nice middle-class household. Domestic violence covers all income stratas, as I think we saw with the Saatchi guy a few years back. It was a nice woman, nice house, and I was with a male and female officer, and they said to her, we have Peter James, the author, with us today. Would you rather he stayed in the car? And she said, no, I'd like him to come in and hear this. So I went in, and she had a breed of puppies, a whole brood of young Labrador puppies, and her live-in boyfriend had come down, trodden in the poo, and lost it. And we sat down at the kitchen table, and the woman officer said to her, "You know, this is the third time he's assaulted you in the past year. We've been out to see you. Why don't you just throw this bastard out?" And she pointed at the wall, and there was half the wall was taken out with a fish tank full of exotic-looking fish. So there's £5,000 worth of fish in there. I don't know how to clean it. I said, "Have you thought of sushi?" And she laughed, and it kind of broke the ice. But when we were leaving, one of the officers said to me, "It's a terrible sadness that so many people are so broken down by domestic violence that they lose all their confidence, all their sense of self-worth and self-esteem, and they're terrified that if they do leave that relationship, however awful it is, that they'll be alone for the rest of their lives, and they'd rather stay in that situation than face that." But all the emergency service workers do incredibly dangerous things. They see sights that most of us hopefully will never see in our lives. And they suffer trauma just as all of us do. I remember the head of the ambulance service saying last year that wearing a uniform does not protect you from trauma. And the previous chief of the Met said, "You know, we are ordinary people doing extraordinary things. While everyone else is running away from danger, we and the other emergency services are running towards it." It's not just their lives that are on the line, it's their sanity as well. I'm co-patron of the Sussex Police Charitable Trust, and we help officers in all kinds of circumstances. You may remember the terrible air disaster in Shoreham that we had in Sussex a couple of years back, when a plane landed on a row of cars and traffic lights and killed 11 people. And I think there were like 3,500 body parts that the police had to recover from that. They have always coped with it with gallows humour, but now the wonderful political correctness lobby makes that harder and harder. But I do find gallows humour still a great way of, when I get exposed to something horrific, and I still find that most police officers privately do as well. My real-life Dave Gaylor once told me the story. I had a scene in an earlier Roy Grace novel where my character, Roy, has to recover a head from a bathtub where the rest of the body's been dissolved in acid. And I wanted to know what a human head felt like. I mean, not many of us just pick one up on its own. So I asked around, and Dave said, "Oh, yes," I had about 20 years ago. There was a guy lay down on the railway line just north of Brighton late at night, and they found his body, but they couldn't find his head. So I had to walk up the line with a torch looking for it. And he said, "It was a horrible wet November night, blowing a hoolie." And he said, "I suddenly saw a pair of eyes looking at me from out of a hawthorn bush." He said, "Well, I didn't like the idea of it looking at me, so I went round behind it, and I was grabbed it by the hair, and I was sort of fighting the bush for it. Finally got it out, and said, out of respect, I decided to take my jacket off and wrap it up." And I then put it in the boot of the car and drove it to the mortuary. And every time I braked or went round a corner, there was this bump, 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 bump. And then when I got there, the rest of the body had been put in this fridge, so the mortician removed it. I still didn't know where to put the head, so I just laid it between his legs so it wouldn't roll off. I don't know what happened to somebody in the morning when they opened that fridge. Villains fascinate me constantly because they come in all different formats, like the Black Widow lady I told you about earlier, who I made a character in my previous Roy Grace novel, Love You Dead, about a woman who targets rich elderly guys. I recently co-wrote a non-fiction book with the former commander of Brighton and Hove, which was published a couple of years back, called Policing Roy Grace's Brighton. And in that, we talked to many of the villains that I'd drawn from in my books and that Graham had encountered during his career. And one wonderful character, guy who's a career burglar. Now, I'm going to give you, as we're coming up to that time of year, Christmas, money gets tighter and harder. I'm going to give you a tip. It's going to give you free groceries for the rest of your lives. Met this career burglar, and he had 176 previous convictions. And I said to him, you know, and it's almost like he came out of prison for a holiday before going back in again. And I said to him, he was a gangly bloke, about 40, very cheerful. And I said, you know what, how did you start your career? He said, well, he grew up on a council estate in Brighton called White Hawk. He said, I was 15, he said, I did my first house. It was a neighbour. I've got 2 years in improved school. He said, I came out of that and I realised you're going to get the same amount of time if you do a poor house or a posh house. So I decided to concentrate on Brighton's posh houses. He said, the problem is I've never been very good. I get caught a lot. He said, one of the first houses is what I did. He said, it's his big house on Dyke Road Avenue in Brighton. He said, what you do is you always leave a back door open or a patio door. So if the law turn up or the owners turn up, you leg it out the back. So it's about 10 o'clock at night, and he said, I'm in there, and patio door I've opened. And the owners turn up. So he said, I'll leg it out the patio door. Didn't realise they had a swimming pool. And I said to him, when you come out of prison, what do you do for money? He said, well, he said, you don't get very much. They give you about 56 quid. He said, so what, I've worked out this thing. He said, I'll go to a big superstore, like a big Tesco, Asda, Waitrose, and I hang around outside till someone comes out with a really big laden trolley and they throws the receipt in the bin. I just take the receipt out the bin, go back in the store, match everything up to the receipt. I'll keep what I want, the rest I'll flog on eBay. So there you go. I gave a talk to all the managers at Tesco a couple of years back and told them this, and they went, oh. So do let me know how you get on, yes? Stuff very rarely happens in real life with the police the way it's portrayed TV or in films. There's always a cock-up. A little while back, I was doing one of my 12-hour shifts, and the duty inspector at 7 in the morning at Brighton, when I rocked up, he said, we just had a tip-off. It's a 5 times wanted armed robber in a flat in Hove. All our armed response units are out. We're going to go and get him. Do you want to come with us? I said, yeah, please, thank you. I said, are we wearing body armour? He said, no. He said, it's fifth floor apartment. He's got a commanding view all around and body armor bulks you up. He said, we want to go incognito. He said, just keep out clear of the door when we go in case he shoots. I said, thanks. So he spends the next 2 hours organizing his teams, and then we drive along Brighton and stop at the top of the street. And this guy is in a 6-story low-rise block down by the seafront. And we get out of the car, and surprise is the key with any raid. Particularly if it's for drugs and it's an apartment block, because if we're not in that door in 20 seconds, they've all gone down the toilet. So everyone's incognito, and we walk down the street, and about every 50 yards, leaning against the lamppost, is somebody incredibly obvious-looking, wearing a beanie, an earpiece, and ripped jeans. And we get down the bottom, and dog handlers turn up, and they go around to cover off the car park and the back entrance. And then the local support team rock up, and they're the heavies with the body armour and the visors. And they got out this plain white van. They said to me, are you coming in with us? And I said, that's okay. He said, yeah, just keep clear of the door in case he shoots. I said, thanks, that's twice. And during the night, they managed to get a key from the caretaker to the front door so they could just get straight in, all part of the speed. So one says, Stan, you got the key? I thought you had it, Bert. Oh, fuck. He said, I left it in the office, in my desk. So then they have to ring all the buttons on the entry phone bell, except the one they're after. And then finally somebody says, yes, hello. And they said, FedEx, thank you. Click. They go in. So we go up the five floors, and I'm staying well at the back, down the corridor. And they first of all ring the doorbell, no answer. Knock on the door, no answer. One of them shouts through the letterbox, you in, Mr. Johnson? And they've got the battering ram, which I'm sure you've seen. They call it the big yellow key. And also these days, a lot of door frames are armoured. They have a grinder that actually pushes the door frame out. So they go, one, two, three, police! Bam! Smash the door in. This guy leaps out at them, shoves the visors up on the two front officers, bites one on the nose and hangs on with his teeth, and jams his fingers in the eyes of the other one. And they throw him on the ground face down, and they put handcuffs on him and leg cuffs. Called a viper. He's like, yo, bastards, he said, I hope you fixed my door. Last time you did this, I got burgled after. And then a little old lady comes out the flat opposite in a dressing gown and says, what the fuck's going on? And the inspector says, madam, this is a police raid. Would you get back inside? Police, I rang you 2 weeks ago because my cat's gone missing and nobody's been in contact. You know, before I throw it open to questions in a second, they say there's a book in everyone, and I'm sure that's true, just not always a book anyone else is going to want to read. Some of you may know the Edward Bulwer-Lytton Award that's awarded annually to the author of the worst possible opening line of a book. I just thought I'd share a few of my favourites with you. Knowing well the hand signals of his platoon leader, Private James Dawson silently dropped to the dirt, concealed and motionless for what seemed an eternity, a move that he'd learned, coincidentally, from his parents whenever the watchtower ladies would ring the doorbell. As she reclined naked on the chaise longue, Constance's breasts looked like two mounds of creamy coleslaw. Served up on a fine porcelain plate. But the good kind of coleslaw, not the violent neon green stuff you get at Kentucky Fried Chicken. As a scientist, Throckmorton knew that if he were ever to break wind in the echo chamber, he would never hear the end of it. She wasn't really my type, a hard-looking but untalented reporter from the local cat box liner. But the first, second, that the third-rate representative of the fourth estate cracked open a new fifth of old scotch, my sixth sense said seventh heaven was as close as an eighth note from Beethoven's ninth. So nervous as a tenth grader, drowning in 11th hour cramming for a physics exam, I swept her into my longing arms, and humming the 12th of Never, I got lucky on Friday the 13th. And I think for every budding writer, this is a must. As his small boat scudded before a brisk breeze, under a sapphire sky, dappled with cerulean clouds, with indigo bases, through cobalt seas that deepened to navy nearer the boat and faded to azure at the horizon, Ian was at a loss as to why he felt blue. I'd be very happy if anyone has any questions, sir.
Well, how do you follow that? If you don't mind, before you put your hands up, I'd like to ask a question myself, which I'm still laughing at some of those early things. Reading that you've done 13 Roy Grace novels, it occurred to me as a Graham Greene fan, one very, very obvious difference, which is that Graham Greene wrote a book, finished with the characters, and moved on to someone else. And sometimes he talks about how his mind got occupied by not really pleasant characters, people you wouldn't necessarily want in your mind. I mean, Pinky might have been one, but I'm thinking in particular the burnt-out case, the query architect, who Green said kind of was in his mind for 18 months and was really glad to put that final full stop, the thing's finished, I've done with that man and I can begin to forget him. I don't want him in my mind. But you've got Roy Grace in your mind time and time and time again. Are the difficulties in doing that? And how do you make a chap like that who recurs develop? Do you feel the need to develop him for your own sake and for the sake of your readers?
I do, yeah. I think that going back in time, if you look at Miss Marple and Poirot, they were exactly the same character in every single book. They didn't change remotely. Whereas I think in modern fiction, it's important. I think Ian Rankin's Rebus develops continually throughout the 26 books he's written. And for me, the way I've done it with Roy Grace, and I really like, I mean, Roy Grace, a lot of Roy Grace is me, in terms of I'm not as brave as him, but I use him as my mouthpiece for things that piss me off. I was particularly pleased, we have a hospital in Brighton where you're far more likely to die of something you pick up from having gone in than whatever's taking you in the first place. And I had Roy really slag it off over several books, and about 6 years ago I got a phone call from the chief exec saying, could we come and see you and try and persuade you to be nicer about us and show you what we're doing? And I thought, result. And with Roy, I had no idea I'd end up now on the 14th book. I mean, Macmillan asked if I'd create a new detective, and I thought, well, I'll introduce him in the first, which was dead simple, and I'll finish in the second, which is Looking Good, Dad. And when I created Roy, I wanted to do something different. I felt that there was very much a cliche in the crime fiction genre of the detective with a drink problem and a broken marriage. And the reality in today's British police force, any police officer with a drink problem wouldn't last 24 hours. Just would not happen. And I thought, you know, what good detectives do, as I alluded to earlier, is they solve puzzles. I thought it'd be interesting to create a detective who had a personal puzzle of his own that he couldn't solve. So when we meet Roy Grace in Dead Simple, we learn that he's just coming up to his 39th birthday, and 10 years earlier on his 30th birthday, he came home and his wife Sandy, who he'd been together with for a decade, loved and adored, had vanished, literally off the face of the earth. And he's been looking for her when we first meet him for 10 years. He doesn't know whether she was abducted, ran off with a lover, had a breakdown, an accident, and he's been constantly looking for her. He's not been able to move on in his own life, but he's continued to function as a very effective homicide detective in that time. And I thought, I will set up the mystery of Sandy in Dead Simple, and I will say what happened in the second book. And Dead Simple came out, and I was inundated with emails from readers speculating what might have happened to Sandy. I thought, I could keep this going. And so I did. And it became really helpful for developing Roy, because he does start to have a new love interest in Cleo, who runs the mortuary. But against that backdrop is the constant worry, is Sandy going to reappear? And my readers seem to have absolutely loved it. I've had the most hysterical emails. I have one, "Dear Mr. James, I've just worked out I'm a lot younger than you, and I imagine I'm a lot fitter, which means you're going to die before me. So I hope you've left the secret of what happens to Sandy safe." And I had a very touching one 18 months ago. "Dear Miss James, I'm 88 years old, and the doctors tell me I'm terminally ill. Please tell me what happens to Sandy. I promise I'll take it to the grave."
And just to follow up on that, you never find it a burden to have Roy Grace in your head so constantly? I mean, you write other things in and between these 13, but you're constantly coming back to him. That's never a burden. It never bores you. It never makes you think, my head's hurting with this chap in there.
No, really, on the contrary. I mean, I do write other books. I have a thriller coming out next October next year, which is completely different. It's called Absolute Proof, and it's on the theme of what would happen if someone credible claimed to have absolute proof of God's existence. Just a small topic. And 4 years ago, I had Perfect People, which was about designer babies. And I have a big interest in science and religion and the paranormal as well. But with Roy Grace, I feel I'm incredibly blessed. And I think, you know, I look at Conan Doyle, he got fed up with Holmes, bumped him off, and then realized he couldn't ever create anything so successful. It's the hardest thing in the world. You know, I said earlier, I think the three most important things in writing is character, followed by research, followed by plot. And, you know, we read books first and foremost to find out what happens to characters we engage with. And it's actually very, very hard to create character, you know, really rounded characters that, you know, there's almost a magic to it. You know, there's no format. You can't read any book on creative writing and go, oh yeah, I know how to make a character people will like. There's some magic element about it, and if you happen to get that, it's incredibly lucky. So I think the last thing I want to do is kill that golden goose. But also, I regard Roy and all his team as mates. Whenever I'm planning a book, I sit down and I go, okay, Roy, how are you? Hi, Norman Potting. Who have you pissed off this week? Hi, Glenn. How's your train crash of a love life? I love it. I enjoy, and also with Dave Gaylor, my real-life Roy Grace, and with Laura, my wife, you know, we kind of discuss constantly and what would be, you know, we kind of brainstorm as well. So, no, I really love it.
Other questions?
Hi. I was going to ask you about the big difference between being a producer and a collaborative person and being a writer, which is normally solitary. But you've answered that. Do you think you would have been so open to collaboration if you hadn't had your background in the collaborative medium of film?
That's a really interesting question, because part of the reason I switched from film and television to writing was that I came to loathe the collaborative elements of it. Because when you make a film, you end up fighting 20 people. You know, you have your co-producers, all with their own egos, who'd say, it's my film, darling. Then you have the director who says, actually, it's my film, darling. Then the director of photography says, he's an absolute asshole. I saved the film, it's my film, darling. Then you have your four lead actors who say, actually, darling, it's our film. And then you have the production designer who says, look, if it didn't look the way it was, it just would be shit. And then you have the editor who says, it was a complete mess. It's my film, darling. I saved it. And then the composer who says, actually, it's the music that made this film. And then your distributor, 20th Century Fox, whoever it is, says, we don't like the ending. Can you reshoot it? And you fight all the time. And I love, I collaborate, you know, with my very close team of my kind of wife and Dave and one or two other kind of trusted people. Writing is basically solitary, and I don't have to change a word. I don't have to ask permission. And I really love that. It's for me, it's much more of a pure creative process.
Thank you very much for a very stimulating talk. I was wondering if you had, on your patrols with the police, you've ever run into crimes with racial elements in them, and are you planning to do any books with that theme?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, Roy Grace's kind of immediate kind of work buddy is black, who I actually met was a real kind of black beat officer in Brighton, and years back, actually, when he was in Eastbourne, and he said to me, he was 32, and I said, it's kind of interesting that you're still a PC, you know, do you have ambitions to, you know, get up through the ranks? He said, I've actually only been in the police 2 years. He said, I was a nightclub bouncer. and my kid was born, and my son, and I looked down at my son one day, and I thought, you're going to go to school, and someone's going to ask you what your dad does, and you're going to say he's a black nightclub bouncer, and I want him to be proud of me. And that was kind of interesting. In Brighton and Sussex, we don't have anything like the kind of racial problem. I go out with the Met quite a bit, and Lara's been out with me on patrol in the Met also quite a bit, and it's a different ball game up there. But you do get incidents, and I don't shy from writing about them. I had one a few years back, and I was on patrol in a neighbourhood policing car in a sink area, sink estate of Brighton. It was 10 o'clock on a Thursday night, and I was with a young sergeant and a very young Indian woman police officer. She was just fresh out of probation. And there were 10 youths necking bottles, which is a criminal offence in Brighton. You cannot have an open bottle of alcohol on the street. So they pull over, and they get out of the car, and I'm sitting in the back, so I get out as well. And I'm just wearing whatever I'm given. Sometimes I get usually a fluorescent jacket. Sometimes it says police on it, sometimes observer, whatever. And it's kicking off. I'm standing at the back with my watching, making notes. One of the youths says, well, I'm not having my bottles taken off by a fucking wog. You know, it's really, you know, nasty. And I could see people squaring up to a fight. And there's two of the officers, me and these 10 yobs. So I thought, right, do I run? Do I get back in the car and shut the door? Or do I join in? And I thought, well, if I'm going to keep respect, I'm going to have to join in. So I look around for which is the shortest one, and I think I'll hit him first. And I was standing there like this, and one of them points at me and says, who the fuck's he? And the sergeant says, he's with the FBI. They became like pussycats. They put their hands up. Respect. In the...
Can I go here first and then I'll...
Thank you, yeah. I was thinking about this cliche, truth is stranger than fiction, and struck in researching Green and by hearing what you said today about the research writing process, about how many real characters and events are in both Green's books and in yours. Is it actually fiction that you're writing?
I think that it's really hard to truly define fiction. I think all writers use life experience in some way or another. Many of my stories I've drawn parallels from real life. I don't know if any of you saw the documentary that was on Sunday night on one of my books about the Rotherham shoe rapist. But that was a story, and it comes quite close to answering yours. I was at a homicide lecture given by the senior investigating officer of one of the most horrible sexual assault cases ever in this country. It happened in Rotherham between 1983 and 1987. A guy was going around late at night targeting women with sexy shoes, sort of high-heeled shoes, outside bars and nightclubs, dragging them into undergrowth or bushes and alleys, raping them, and then he'd steal their shoes. And in fact, he stopped in 1987. Trail went completely cold. And it turned out the reason he stopped was he'd got married for the second time and started a new family. And that often is a pattern, a break in a serial crime for some left-field reason. 2003, a woman got stopped drink driving in Rotherham. And the police took a DNA swab and they got a familial match to the rapist. I still had the records. And they said to her, do you have a brother? And she said, yes, but he's a very respectable businessman. And he was. He was a works manager of a big printing firm in Rotherham. And she phoned him up and said, I've just had a very strange call from the police. His reaction was to try and hang himself in his garage that night. And the next day, his son came home, luckily by chance, and cut him down. The next day, the police raided his office, and under his desk was a trap door, and they found 126 pairs of ladies' shoes, all beautiful condition, wrapped up, some with a bow around them. and it got a life sentence. And I drew very extensively on that. I'd always wanted to write about rape, but I'd never wanted to write about it in a gratuitous way. And I wanted a story that just fascinated me, that kind of obsession with Jews. Oddly enough, after the book came out, I had quite a lot of emails from men thanking me for curing their wives of their expensive shoe habit.
Just one more, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you very much for an absolutely marvellous talk. I wanted to ask, can you ever imagine yourself committing a crime? Are there particular crimes that you might fantasize about committing, or perhaps fear that you could commit?
Oh yeah, I think I could happily murder anyone who gives me a 1-star Amazon review. Very slowly, slicing bits off them and roasting them with a nice Chianti. Oh, absolutely, I could commit the perfect murder. No question. What I couldn't do is live with the knowledge of having done it, which is what catches out so many people. You know, we all are able to kill. You know, we've all got the apparatus, and you've got some ties in your closet. You've probably got a nice sharp knife in the kitchen, bathroom cabinet full of pills, shovel, body bin liner, saw. You know, every one of us in this room has got the apparatus to kill and dispose of a body. But very few people can do it and actually get away with it. What the classic scenario tends to be that you have a couple, you know, Fred and Doris, apologies if anyone here, that name, and Fred falls in love with Wendy, his girlfriend, and he thinks, you know, it's going to be very expensive to divorce Doris, much easier for bumper off. So he does, kills her, re-screeds the kitchen floor, puts her underneath, tells all his mates, oh, Doris has buggered off to go live with her sister in Auckland. And it's a very easy thing to do. It's much easier than people realize to do that. But what happens is, at some point, Fred has to tell someone. So a month, 2 months later, he takes his best friend Bill out for a pint. He says, Bill, I actually murdered Doris, but it's all right, isn't it, because I love Wendy. And he says, it's not all right, and now you've told me I'm an accomplice to murder. So one of us is going to have to go to the police. And that's what gets so many of them, is that we can't live with the conscience of doing it. So I had a novella called The Perfect Murder, and I explored that theme a lot, and it was made into a stage play, which some of you may have seen and toured a couple of times. And it's a very interesting theme, that. When I was at school, I used to dream of pulling off a really good bank robbery. Of not hurting anyone, but, you know, of actually sort of tunneling into the Bank of England. Then somebody did it. While everybody else was sitting in class doing geography, I was drawing my tunnels into the vaults.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, I suspect we could explore that a bit further, but we better not, in case you start to be an idea, Peter. That's been absolutely fascinating, very entertaining. Thank you very much.
Thank you.